It's Thursday, March 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, voters make the U.S. presidential race just a bit clearer. Financial markets make a welcome turn. Will the trend last?
There is the awareness that these are not long-term solutions.
European migrants continue to struggle in their movement to a better life. Also ahead, a year in space concludes, successfully, and the latest automotive technology is on display. It's all on today's International Edition. The road to the White House became somewhat clearer following Super Tuesday. That's a single day of primary and caucus voting that included 12 of the 50 U.S. states. Donald Trump extended his strong showing with Republican voters, while Hillary Clinton remained steady against her lone Democrat challenger, Bernie Sanders. The Republican field was very crowded at the start, but it's thinned out now, and an early leader has made an exit. Enter VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone to tell us more.
Dr. Ben Carson appears to be packing it in. He's announced he's not going to be taking part in the upcoming Republican debate, and saying simply in an email message that there's no path forward right now for him. The question is, does his departure mean anything for the rest of the contenders? Well, it's possible that Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, according to some of the polls, could benefit a little bit from a Carson exit. Some of Carson's supporters seem more inclined to support them than, say, Donald Trump. But at this point, it's probably not likely to have a major impact. I think most of the discussion right now is about the big performance by Donald Trump on Super Tuesday, but maybe just leaving the door open a little bit to being blocked. And I think that's what we're looking at right now. Can he be blocked from winning the nomination outright before the party convention in July?
And quote, the Republican strategist has been dreading this day when Donald Trump seems to be consolidating the voter base and appears to be on his way to the nomination.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though. Associated Press did a little look at some of the mathematics here, and so far he's won 46% of the delegates. He's going to have to increase that margin as we go forward. Remember, it's, to this point, proportional delegate allocation, depending on how well you do. So even though Donald Trump won 7 of 11 primary and caucus events on Super Tuesday, well, Ted Cruz wasn't that far behind in the delegate count because he also reaped some delegates. Even Marco Rubio got some. That will change, though, beginning March 15th, and that's why I think we're in a two-week window now, which is really the last chance for the Republican establishment to see if they can derail Donald Trump. After that, it gets a lot more problematic. If Trump can continue his win scheme in some of these primaries, some of them are winner-take-all, and he can build a really big lead heading for Cleveland in July.
Ted Cruz, of course, to the very far right in the Republican Party, and he does well with evangelicals, although Trump has also made some big inroads there. Cruz makes the argument that, hey, you know, you have to win a few states to have a shot at, you know, being the person who can knock Trump out of this, and he claims that he has done that.
And he has something to fall back on. Marco Rubio had a small breakthrough with a victory in the Minnesota caucuses, but not much to write home about, really. And so Cruz can at least, you know, make the argument they should unite behind him. Is that going to happen? Probably not, because on March 15th, both Marco Rubio and John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, have home state primaries, and both intend on trying to win them. The problem for Rubio in particular is that Trump has a sizable lead in Florida. Maybe that'll change in the next few weeks. Rubio claims that by attacking Trump in the days leading up to Super Tuesday, it brought down his numbers a bit. There's some suggestion that the exit polls show that people who decided at the last minute tended to go with Rubio and not Trump. So maybe those attacks on Trump's character were having an effect. Maybe it was too little too late.
Well, we're looking forward to what comes down the road. Our senior national correspondent, Jim Malone, thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
And now we have our own G. Abby Lee in the studio to bring us the social media perspective of our top story. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Let's begin with Ben Carson. What did he tweet?
So as Jim Malone mentioned earlier, Carson announced he's ending his presidential campaign. He's on Twitter at RealBenCarson and tweeted this about 2 hours ago. Read my statement on this Thursday night's hashtag GOP debate. Click here. And if you click on that link, the link takes you to his campaign page. He wrote, I do not see a political path forward in light of last evening's Super Tuesday primary results. He added he will not attend Thursday's debate. He did say, however, that he will give a speech on Friday at CPAC right here in Washington.
Well, saying goodbye is always difficult. He's not the only GOP candidate that people are talking about, though,
right? Not at all.
Okay, what's the back and forth between Donald Trump and Nikki Haley?
Yeah, so Donald Trump, as many of our listeners already know, is the GOP frontrunner. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley endorses rival Marco Rubio, so naturally they're not a fan of each other. His latest tweet targeting her reads like this. The people of South Carolina are embarrassed by Nikki Haley. Her response to that was pretty short and sweet. Bless your heart. Now, a reply with the most number of likes to that tweet reads, that's Southern for bleep, bleep, bleep. So it's a bit hard to explain what it is, but I would say bless your heart is a way of saying something quite cutting without actually saying it. Jim, what do you think?
Yes, I think you're absolutely correct. Probably not the kindest of words, but in a nice way. Well, staying with Trump, what else did he tweet?
He tweeted his wife's interview with Fox News will air later today and ended the tweet with enjoy. He sent out a similar tweet with her appearance on CNN Monday, also ending the tweet with enjoy. Before I go, I want to quickly mention that six newspapers from New Jersey urged Governor Chris Christie to resign from the position. In the joint editorial about him after his endorsement of Trump, they wrote they're fed up with his opportunism. The editorial also said he spent 261 days outside of the state. Back to you.
Well, thanks for that wrap-up, G. She's also on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. You can follow me as well, at VOA Stevenson. And our program's account is at VOA underscore IE. We invite you to follow all of those streams. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition. The European Union's executive body has announced a plan to provide Greece and other EU nations with $760 million in aid to help them cope with a growing influx of migrants. The EU Commission says the aid is meant to cover the migrants' basic necessities, such as food, shelter, clean water, and emergency health care, for a three-year period. Greece has been taking in by far the greatest number of migrants so far this year, more than 100,000, according to the International Organization for Migration. The migrant crisis is the focus of this week's hashtag VOA program, and host Michael Lippin joins me right here in the studio. Michael, who was on your panel this time?
Hi, Jim. Thank you. Well, we had two panelists on hashtag VOA, a freelance journalist who reported from the Greek island of Lesbos just last week. That's one of the top destinations for migrants trying to reach Greece from Turkey. And I also spoke with RAND Europe senior analyst Giacomo Percipaoli via Skype from Italy. Now, Percipaoli has been examining the political impact of the crisis, and I asked him what's been motivating some EU members, such as Austria and Balkan states, to try to stop the migrants from leaving Greece and entering their territories.
I think that every country in Europe realizes that unilateral actions are certainly not a solution to the problem. It is reasonable to believe that these kind of unilateral initiatives are taken as a kind of temporary solution to the lack of effect, if you want, or impact of European action as a whole. So there are arguments both in favor and against the temporary reinstatement of border controls, which are part of the Schengen Agreement in case of exceptional circumstances that may present a threat to national safety or public safety. But of course, by these kind of individual initiatives are basically moving pressure points from one border to the other, and everyone knows that. So there is the awareness that these are not long-term solutions.
Right, and part of these new pressure points is a buildup of migrants in Greece along the border with Macedonia, because Macedonia is not allowing many of those migrants to enter. I wanted to get a sense from you, Giacomo, about how these national unilateral actions are going to affect the outcome of next week's summit. There's going to be a summit between the European Union leaders and Turkey to try to come up with a unified solution. What impact will these steps have?
So the summit, next week's summit with Turkey, is a step or an additional step. This is part of the long-term plan or a joint plan that has been agreed back in October between the EU and Turkey, and the EU has already committed something like 3 billion euros of funding supporting Turkey in dealing with kind of the humanitarian crisis, the humanitarian status and consequences of the migrants that are entering Turkey from Syria. There is what Europe really needs to do is appear as a credible and united international player in the kind of international policy arena. And of course, this sort of strong national positions may kind of jeopardize the image, the joint and united image.
Now, in the program, we also hear from that journalist whom I mentioned. Her name is Laurel Bowman. She took her iPhone to Lesbos and filmed her conversations with migrants who had just landed on the island, as well as the volunteers who were helping them. Bowman also produced a beautiful video piece of that visit, and you can see it by going to our hashtag VOA Facebook page, and that's where you can watch the full show. Jim?
All right. Thank you so much, Michael Lippin, who hosted this week's hashtag VOA show. And I believe you can also find it on our website at voanews.com.
That's right. voanews.com/hashtag VOA.
Thank you so much, Michael. Well, while many uncertainties remain in global financial markets, especially with respect to oil, stocks traded in the U.S. markets have mostly seen a positive trend recently. But investors are being cautious after a steep decline's open 2016. VOA Economics correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York about this welcomed trend reversal.
Well, since February 11th, most markets have turned north. And the question that traders have, can the momentum continue? On Tuesday, we saw a stunning, almost 50-point rally in the S&P. Today, it's been very choppy trade, even though we're relatively flat on the day. What I find interesting is, even though we saw that 50-point move and we're well off the lows from February 11th, the moves have been incredibly extreme. That's not a sign of a healthy bull market. It almost feels like what we call a bear bounce rally. The reason being is when you're looking at a market to the up or downside, you want to see confirmation of the direction slow and steady. When you see 50-point swings in one day, trading, you know, 10-point ranges within 15, 20 minutes, it's just not a healthy market. It shows that traders don't trust the action. It shows that it's sector rotation. It's the machines, for the most part, playing ping pong based on different levels that they're looking at in the market. We're not seeing that fresh money come in from the sidelines. It's more sector rotation out of utilities, out of defensive names, out of other asset classes that performed well in the January downturn, and now they're looking to pick up assets in the energy sector, in the financial sector, which was beaten up so badly. And while I get the sector rotation theme, fundamentals remain weak, and that's what concerns me about the trading action that we're seeing.
And it sounds like it's a lot of short-term opportunists.
It's great for a short-term day or swing trader, assuming that you're on the right side of the trade. Going to trade on Tuesday, if you were short the market, where the futures were pointing to a lower open and it ripped 50 points in your face, that's not a good thing. But if you're able to trade, you know, these types of swings intraday and be on the right side, it could be fascinating. For a longer-term trader, someone like you, someone like me, we're investors. We're not traders. There's a very, very big difference. That's when you take a look at your 401k, you know, once half a year, once every year, and all these swings seem to average out. So that's why I'm not too concerned. I still think it's a great time to constantly invest in the market when you have a longer-term time horizon and kind of filter out a lot of the noise that you hear in financial media markets, because there are still some great values out there in the tech sector, for example, in the consumer space, for example. Even in the energy space, you have some good dividend players that just have to ride out the weakness that we're seeing in oil. And longer term, these are the times that you want to buy when there's uncertainty.
We always enjoy getting the long-term perspective from Jill Malandrino in New York. Jill, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
After 340 days in orbit, American astronaut Scott Kelly and Russian cosmonaut Mikhail Kornienko have returned safely to Earth. A Russian Soyuz spacecraft carrying Kelly and Kornienko and a second Russian cosmonaut, Sergei Volkov, made a soft landing on the frozen steppes of Kazakhstan early Wednesday, 3 hours after separating from the International Space Station. Volkov is back after spending the last 6 months aboard the ISS. That's the typical mission length for space station crews. Kelly now holds the American record for the longest continuous time in space as he and Kornienko circled the world 5,440 times aboard the ISS. They covered 144 million miles and witnessed 10,880 orbital sunrises and sunsets. The duo's mission was designed to measure how long-term stay in microgravity environment impacts the human body and mind, with an eye toward planning for future multi-year missions that will be necessary to take crews to Mars or other places in our solar system. Well, while it might be a little difficult for them to walk for a while, they might want to hop into a car. Car lovers worldwide have their eyes on Switzerland this month, where the Geneva Auto Show features innovations in automotive design and technology. International Edition's David Byrd reports that small SUVs are all the rage, as are concept cars that include self-driving technology.
A generation ago, many families had station wagons. Now, the sport utility vehicle has taken over as the way to haul both people and things. But SUVs had one drawback. They were thirsty. With more fuel efficiency mandated on the European continent, automakers had to come up with a solution fast. The car makers have brought several more fuel-efficient models alongside electric and hybrid cars to the Geneva Auto Show. Tim Pollard is the editor-in-chief of Car Magazine.
Every stand here at the Geneva Motor Show will have crossovers, SUVs. This is a segment which continues to grow. By 2020, car makers tell me it's going to account for at least a quarter of the European car market. So we're flabbergasted. You know, the continual shift away from MPVs, people carriers and the like. SUVs show no sign of slowing down anytime soon.
Europe's car industry has been struggling since the Eurozone crisis over bank debt started in 2009. But it did emerge from the slow market last year, and SUVs are leading the way. Tim Urquhart is an analyst at IHS Automotive.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very profitable business, largely because the car makers can base these crossovers and SUVs on conventional car underpinnings, platforms, and powertrains and use the same technology. So you get two models for the price of one, basically. It's the way customer trends are going. It's the way the market is going. And they're able to also integrate very efficient powertrains into these cars. So just because they're notionally crossovers and SUVs doesn't mean they're gas guzzlers as well.
But it's not just SUVs that are catching attention. Self-driving vehicles are also on the horizon. In Geneva, Nissan showcased its driverless IDS concept car with a retractable steering wheel. Nissan Europe chairman Paul Wilcox says that drivers can look for an autonomous piloted highway model next year.
In 2017, we'll be announcing the first ladder up of autonomous drive features on Qashqai. So we're announcing we'll have autonomous highway piloted autonomous features on Qashqai from next year. So we have the first step in place in Europe from 2017.
And if high performance is your taste, then Bugatti rolled out just what you're looking for, a 2.4 million euro Chiron. The supercar features a W16 8-liter engine, which blasts out 1,500 horsepower and has a maximum speed of 420 kilometers per hour. Or maybe the Lamborghini Centenario is more your speed. The sleek, windswept supercar marks 100 years since the birth of Lamborghini founder Ferruccio Lamborghini. It has a 770-horsepower engine, and its shell is made entirely of carbon fiber. But it is a look-don't-touch car at Geneva. Only 40 of the Lambos were made this year, and they have all sold for around 2 million euros each. The Geneva Auto Show runs until March 13th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Time for us to hop in our cars and depart, but not to worry. Only for a short time, we'll be back at this time tomorrow. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After a recent meeting with his National Security Council team, President Barack Obama said the only way to defeat ISIL in a way that lasts is to end the chaos and the civil war that has engulfed Syria for the last 5 years. The cessation of hostilities that was agreed to by Russia, the United States, and other members of the International Syria Support Group on February 22nd, and which went into effect February 27th, is a test, Mr. Obama said, of whether the parties involved are truly committed to negotiations. The process agreed to in Vienna is clear: a transition toward a more inclusive, representative government, a new government, a new constitution, followed by free elections. Acknowledging differences with Russia and Iran on the issue, President Obama reiterated his conviction that Syria's new future cannot include Bashar al-Assad.
It's clear that after years of his barbaric war against his own people, including torture and barrel bombs and sieges and starvation, many Syrians will never stop fighting until Assad is out of power. There's no alternative to a managed transition away from Assad. It's the only way to end the civil war and unite the Syrian people against terrorists.
President Obama said that a political settlement that would end the civil war means that all parties could then turn their attention to the crucial task of destroying ISIL.
And that's why the United States will do everything we can to maximize the chances of success in this cessation of hostilities. At the same time, I want to make totally clear that there will be absolutely no ceasefire with respect to ISIL. We remain relentless in going after them.
President Obama noted that the U.S.-led coalition with its local partners and allies is making headway in shrinking the core of ISIL in Syria and in Iraq. ISIL's control of territory has been diminished. Its leaders have been killed. Its flow of foreign fighters has been slowed. Its finances have been disrupted. The fight against ISIL will remain difficult, said President Obama, but we will continue to draw on all elements of our national power, military, intelligence, diplomacy, homeland security, law enforcement, and the strength of our communities. And I am confident that we will prevail.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.